I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Motormouth podcast with me, Tim Silvey. Today, co-hosting with me, back for her second time on the show, is Nadia El Fadousi. So thank you for her for joining me once again. Today, Nadia and I were joined by a pretty amazing guy, Cameron Daz. He's come to the UK from America. He's competed at extremely high levels of motorsport in the US and over here in the UK and Europe. He was reaching a point where he was being approached by Formula 2 teams, but the money was just too much. He couldn't stretch his budget out any longer to the levels that were required, the many millions that you need to compete in F2 and then get to Formula 1. So he decided to focus on something else. He moved into content creation. That's what he's done. And he's amassed over 600,000 YouTube subscribers and hundreds of thousands of social followers. And forged a whole new career. It's really quite remarkable. But will we see him back in a racing car? He's doing this to raise money to go racing. At least that's what he was doing. Now it's become a career. The decision to leave or step away might be even more challenging, or perhaps he'll run both alongside each other, content creator and racing driver. But let's dive into it. Let's hear what he thinks about his thoughts on content creation, his journey so far, his return to racing, and a whole lot more. Enjoy. Cameron, welcome to the show. Now, take us back. Where was home? What was life like as a youngster? Where did you grow up? You're not from these parts, obviously. What shaped you as a youngster?
Well, as a kid growing up, I wasn't really into racing at all. I was a car nut. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, which is, you know, near Washington, D.C. area, East Coast, U.S., and I wasn't athletic. I wasn't into sports. I was kind of a computer nerd more than anything. And just kind of over the years, I had been playing Forza and different sort of arcade racing games like that over the years, never really thinking it ever amount to anything. But my parents always remind me that when I was a little kid, that the thing that I wanted to be, that I said I wanted to be, was a NASCAR driver. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how to get there. It wasn't really a kid wanting to be an astronaut or something. But then years later, when I was 14, I hopped into a go-kart and ended up being pretty quick. And really, the rest is history, I guess.
Were you immediately quick in a go-kart? Did you get in and think, yes, I've got a natural affinity to this and this is something I should pursue?
Well, it's kind of a little bit different of a backstory. The go-kart that I was quick in was an indoor electric rental cart. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, I was quick straight away. And people who worked at the facility were like, oh, that's unusual considering you don't have any experience. Like, come back and do our adult pro league. And this is when I was 14 years old. So this was end of 2014. And so, like, yes, I was quick, but then, you know, probably not in the most competitive of an environment. So it didn't necessarily, I wasn't like instantly like, oh, I could be a race car driver from this. It wasn't until probably 6 months later that that became a reality.
So at that point, did you think this is the career that I'm going to go into? This is for me? Or did you have anything else as a plan B?
Definitely wasn't thinking about it in terms of a career. I think the people around me were, and they just didn't say. They just kind of wanted to see, one, if I could keep performing at the levels that I was kind of moving up through. And number two, whether or not I actually liked it enough for it to be a career. And that was the easy question because, I mean, it was, I was getting to race at a, you know, in my teenage years, and I had no idea that, you know, it could even be possible to come from rental karting and from gaming really, and perform in a race car. But when I got into a real race car for the first time, there's a school in the US, which I don't think exists anymore, but it was called Bertel Roos Racing School. And basically some of my competitors in rental karting, you know, had been doing amateur SCCA racing in the States. Some of them actually semi-professional stuff. And they were the ones who said, they called up the school owner at Bertel Roos and said, hey, this kid is different. We don't know if he's going to be good in a race car, but give him a shot. And they did. And I won the race at the end of the week. And it was really, you know, that relationship through Bertel Roos that ended up giving me all the contacts to be able to actually get into Formula Ford cars and stuff and do some testing kind of throughout 2015. And then 18 months after my first rental karting outing, I became F4 US champion. And then it wasn't really until that day when I won the championship that I really realized that, like, okay, this could be something. Up until that point, it was like, I'm just going to live to fight another day and see what happens.
That's very cool. Now, what's the landscape of racing like in the US at the moment? If you're a young junior coming up through the ranks, obviously in Europe, it's incredibly challenging and there's lots of different series all around Europe, and it's to crack it is really, really difficult. Is it similar in the US? I mean, I know that the feeder series, like going into IndyCar, there's a relatively good ladder there, but how hard is it to make progress from the US, particularly if you want to make it all the way and get to Formula One?
Well, in terms of getting into Formula One, I think it's much more challenging because you're not learning the tracks. You're not learning most of the tracks you need to be competitive in sort of like the F2, F3 arena. But if you're trying to go to IndyCar or into professional sports car racing or something like that, I think the US is much easier than trying to do something similar over in Europe. For starters, you have prize money in a lot of the series. It's come down a little bit in the Road to Indy series in the last couple of years, but I mean, if you win, you can get the funding to move up to the next level, which is just not the case in Europe. On top of that, I think sponsorship is just much easier to find in the US than in Europe. Maybe that's just because I'm American, but I think there's more of an understanding for it. It's like when you listen to an IndyCar driver or a NASCAR driver do an interview, a post-race interview or something on TV, it's always like, oh, my Monster Energy, Honda, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's just more of a sentiment around like the driver's there to promote something and to provide value for the brand. Whereas I think in the European scene, especially below F1, a lot of the money is coming from driver families or driver networks anyway. So there isn't necessarily this need to actually be a spokesperson. So the US, I think, is better in that regard.
That's interesting, Cameron. And speaking of the differences between the US and the UK, I know you're in England now. How is Formula One viewed in America and how has it changed over the last few years?
It's changed massively. I always remember like when I first started racing, even when I had started racing in British Formula 3, my closest friends back home thought I raced NASCAR. I'd shown them pictures of the car, but they still thought I raced NASCAR. And now those same friends today are like, you know, they'll watch a Drive to Survive episode or they'll watch the Bahrain Grand Prix and they'll be like, why did Verstappen go for a dive bomb? And why did he change his brake bias on lap 42 or whatever? It's like the sentiments change completely in the US. And it really, you know, I have to give credit to Drive to Survive for doing that. They've certainly brought a lot more eyeballs. I wouldn't say they're all quality eyeballs because there's definitely a lot of, there's a lot of audience that just, you know, they're there for the drama, as you guys know. And they're not necessarily there because they're passionate racing fans. There's pros and cons to that. But yeah, I've certainly taken advantage of that from from the social media side of things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we'll come on to those social bits and pieces shortly. But I want to touch on your move to Europe, because you, in 2016, which feels like an age ago now, you raced in British Formula 3 in the Autumn Trophy. What was that like as an experience coming over here as a young guy? Were you accompanied? Did you come with other people? Like, what was it like coming over here, the wet, the winds, the rain, and getting on track in the UK for the first time?
Yeah, the Autumn Trophy, I for some reason remember being a traumatic experience. I did a full season of British F3 the year after, and that went really well. But yeah, the first experience in Europe, I had been doing really well in F4. I can't remember when the Autumn Trophy actually was, if I had won the F4 championship by then or not. But yeah, I just remember it being like, okay, this is a different level. Like, F4 US is pretty competitive, but like, It you could tell straight away in the first free practice session that these guys have been, most of them in racing since they were like 5-6 years old. A lot of the drivers knew each other from like karting in Italy or karting in the UK, and they were aggressive even at free practice sessions. So I was very much out of my depths at that point, which I, you know, everyone told me in the States that I would be, but I was in the mentality, I was like, I'm just going to jump in the deep end. Either I'm going to sink or swim. It might take me like a couple tries, but I mean, I don't want to do racing unless I can perform at the highest level. So I may as well go and try and compete with the best. And so the Autumn Trophy, I don't remember what my results were. I think it got delayed by fog or something, as you'd expect in Snetterton. But yeah, I think the next season, kind of through a winter testing program, I pulled on the first official race of British F3. And I think that was like, okay, yeah, okay, this is a different level, but it's possible. And the rest of the season was relatively successful.
Yeah, and it's around this sort of time that things started to change for you a little bit, because as many of our listeners will know, it's bloody expensive to race single-seater cars. And particularly over in Europe, you can spend millions of pounds before you even get to Formula One. And as someone who I assume doesn't have bottomless pits of cash, it became challenging for you to keep racing. So you decided to turn to perhaps your inner nerd that you mentioned earlier and start looking online and going digital and considering content. Did you have any idea? Was it sort of pre-planned? And did you have any idea that you could actually do it and it would go on to become the success that it has been?
Yeah, well, actually, I wanted to do the social media thing and the content thing from day one when I started racing, because my background before I started racing was I wanted to be a film director. So I was going to film schools in the summer. I was entering film festival, like local film festivals, and I won a few awards, kind of local in the Maryland area, you know, growing up in middle school and high school. But then when racing kind of came, it took over everything. I couldn't do both at a very high level. And then sort of, I always knew that like the content side of it would be really valuable for the racing. But especially in European racing, the teams just got real sensitive about it. Like, and I get it, because if I really want to like open the curtain and show the behind the scenes and be like the character I knew I needed to be for the content to do well, I'd have to, you know, give away some of the team secrets, and they were not comfortable with that. And also, I probably wasn't confident enough to demand it, really, because as the driver who has to bring the money to the team, I probably could have. But yeah, it wasn't until basically that I had no other choice but to try and raise money through the content side of things that I really took it seriously. And that's a bit of a regret of mine, that I should have done it earlier. But yeah, it clearly works.
That's so interesting, Cameron, because obviously, like you say, creating that content could have brought the sponsors and the money that you needed to progress. And thinking back to years ago when Lewis wanted to show bits on Instagram of what was happening behind the scenes, and he was told by Bernie, mm-hmm. no, absolutely not. And now look at what's happened. What do you make of the F1 teams and the drivers and the massive uptick in social media?
Yeah, I think it was a no-brainer. I'm really surprised that the series could survive or even thrive without it. But I think it's just this transition. Liberty Media is really trying to make this an evergreen sport that anybody can watch. And Drive to Survive's helped that. Social media is certainly helping that. It's just, I wish they had started that whole process a little bit earlier. But yeah, drivers today, I mean, if they're not taking advantage of social media, then they're leaving a lot on the table. And so many of them aren't. They're still doing what every driver's ever always done, which is like either they rely on family backing or they do some sort of B2B hospitality thing like traditional motorsports sponsorship, which works. But I don't think that's going to work long term in the new age when brands are really going to want, you know, those social media impressions. So yeah, it's a new landscape. And I think we're going to see a lot more drivers rise up, not just because they have money, but because they have that presence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at Valtteri Bottas. I mean, he's completely reinvented himself since he joined the team. And he that video he put out the other day has had global traction across social media, not taking himself too seriously and peeling back the curtain on his character, which is super important. Do you think then it's not being done enough? Is that across the board in motorsport generally? You think people aren't leveraging social media enough? I mean, you look at what you're doing. You've got 600,000 or so on YouTube and a few hundred thousand across socials. You're nailing it. But has it come easy for you? Could people look at you and go, well, it's all right for you, Cameron. You know, you've got the right personality, or you've got the equipment, or, you know, is there an excuse for people not to be doing this if they're a racing driver?
The only excuse is time. The only reason I was able to be successful with it was because I decided, instead of doing a sidestep, I had offers to do F2 after winning Euro Formula and really good offers, good budgets, good teams. But I couldn't raise the money for it the traditional way. So I was like, I'd rather not race than sidestep or go down sports car racing, which was maybe me being a bit stubborn more than anything. But I really did feel like I needed to reinvent the wheel and hopefully it would help other drivers as well later down the line. So yeah, I went full time on content, which is really the only reason why it was so successful so quickly. That's the only excuse. Everything else, when it comes to equipment, when it comes to personality, like that's all stuff that, I mean, I film most of my stuff on an iPhone. I film on a regular Mac laptop, which maybe isn't the cheapest thing in the world, but like I think most drivers could swing it. And when you think about it, it's like, okay, let's say time is the biggest concern. That can be solved with, building a team. And there's plenty of people you could reach out to do that. And when you think how much it would cost to run a YouTube channel, you could easily do it for a fraction of what your racing season budget is. You know, like if you're going to spend like €1 million on FIF3, or I think it's way more than that these days, but like €1.5 million, and you just decide to spend even 50, maybe even 100,000, you go crazy. I mean, that's a relatively small percentage of your racing season budget, and it would make a huge impact. And at least you could even try and make money back from that.
So was your plan ever to raise the funds through content creation and get back to racing? Or at that point, did you decide, this is it, I'm going full-time content creator and this is the path for me now?
No, the original thing was I wanted to use social media to raise budget for Formula 2. But I knew back then I needed to raise probably 3 to 4 million euros for a season, because I was going to spend €1 million on hospitality, right? Because I need to actually cater to these sponsors, and then maybe, I don't know, a certain percentage on digital advertising as well for them. So yeah, I knew it wasn't going to be cheap, and F2's, I've heard, has basically doubled in price since then. So yeah, I YouTube, at least where I'm at now, would not be able to do that. I was hoping that it would take a shorter amount of time despite the growth being pretty meteoric, but it's a hard thing to describe because the social media stuff is still so new age. And then racing and social media is also a completely new thing. So trying to like convey that to brands that have that kind of spending power is not easy. And so I haven't been able to do F2 level stuff. And I probably won't, because at this point, I'm probably getting a bit old for F2. But yeah, for IndyCar or something in the States, I think it's definitely doable.
It's really interesting. It's going to be fascinating to see how your career pans out over the next few years, whether, we see you back on the track full time, or whether, you just continue growing in the online space. Cause there are people, creators, making a very good living with less followers than you have. So, I guess there's going to come a point, isn't there, where you're like, well, do I put all my eggs in one basket now and just, I'm a creator, or do I risk it all and go back to racing? Do you have like a, have you thought through the weighting of that, like which direction you think you're going to go in?
In my head, it's always been, I want to build the content stuff into a real business that can sustain itself. Like, of course, I'm going to always, I mean, my name, the channel is my name. So I'm going to be a personality in it always. But, you know, I think especially if the content is around the racing or it can feed off the racing, then it should only be, you know, a value add to the racing. It's not going to be something that attracts my attention from it. Right now, I'm still way too heavily involved in producing the content. It was just me for a long time. And then I've slowly been hiring people to try and automate some of the processes. But when it's fully automated, which I'm hoping to by the end of this year, then hopefully, then I should be able to go full-time racing and be competitive and not necessarily have to pick one over the other.
Speaking of IndyCar, it's not a series that I follow, but I did watch Bus Bros on YouTube, and what they've done is incredible to attract more fans to the sport and I suppose sponsorship as well. And we just touched on sponsorship. And I wanted to ask you if you know much about F1 Academy and what they're doing. And like, they have attracted huge brands like Charlotte Tilbury, Tommy Hilfiger. What do you think is going to be the pathway to progression for women in up to Formula One?
I think the social media is going to be a big angle as well, because brands need, like, they need stories. I think this is what I've realized from doing brand deals in the social media stuff. They really want stories of, like, whether it's underdog story or whether it's just something that an audience can truly connect with. But I think the F1 Academy is such an interesting program because you've got people from such variety of backgrounds that as long as those drivers are able to tap into their unique story and sell that to advertisers, then they're going to have actually a pretty big advantage, because it's not the typical, like, hey, my dad was a Formula One driver and I had an unlimited budget going through karting. Like, that story is not, you can't pitch that to an advertiser and then, you know, fund the rest of your career from it. So I think, yeah, if F1 Academy drivers can tap into that, it's a massive advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like you've got a career as a sponsorship consultant as well, Cameron. It's funny. I was on a podcast yesterday and we were talking about sponsorship. It was the Missed Apex podcast, and we were chatting through what makes you stand out as a racing driver to get that sponsorship. And I totally agree with you. You've got to find that unique point that you have that no one else has. And there are so many different ways that you can do it. One of the things I referenced yesterday in this show was, you know, young drivers are, so sponsorship's been my thing for the last 18, 19 years. It's what I've done in Formula One. And young drivers often contact me through LinkedIn or social or whatever. And are like, you know, I've got photos and I've got video content and, you know, I can put a logo on my car and all this. And it frustrates me so much because there's never a point of difference. And one guy I was talking to, I was like, have you got a go-kart track near you? Yes, I have. Right. Well, go and negotiate to get their go-kart track for free for half a day, once in the year, and get all 20 karts together and invite all your local businesses to come down and have a free karting session with you. You can do some coaching. You can do some laps. You can put some branding around the place. Like, you've got to add things to your offering that nobody else is going to do. And there are so many just sort of textbook, reproductions of one guy doing exactly the same as the next guy or girl without any point of difference. It sounds like you've kind of got your head around the fact you have to stand out somehow in order to get those funds if you want to go racing and you haven't got government or daddy's money in your pocket.
Yeah, I mean, I hit a roadblock trying to do it the traditional way. Like, it worked for, you know, it worked for a time. But then when we got to the crazy numbers of you know, sort of the high-end Formula Ladder series, I was like, well, something's got to change. I mean, nobody else has done it successfully. Maybe it won't work, but I've got to try.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a powerful asset there now when you ever do go back racing. And, you know, by the time you're back racing, maybe you'll have the million followers or the million subs on YouTube. And, you know, to have that as a resource and as something to package up and sell to partners or investors or sponsors is hugely valuable. So it's very, very impressive with what you've done. Let's talk about Formula One quickly. We've got Australia this weekend. We've had the time of recording FP1 and 2, and I'm not sure how much we can read into that just yet, but what are you expecting to see in Melbourne this weekend?
The racing looks close. I mean, all I've looked at is the FP1 results and highlights. I haven't been super involved in F1, honestly, this year. I've been so busy with the content stuff. But yeah, I mean, I saw the FP1 results were the closest we've seen in a long, long time, actually, and a big variety of teams as well. So not that Melbourne's the best track to race on, but I think the racing will be tight and maybe there'll be a Red Bull upset, maybe. Norris is looking pretty quick. And I actually, you know what I've been finding really interesting is Hamilton's struggle relative to Russell. Like, this may be the junior driver mentality, but like whenever a driver kind of is like, you already know that they're leaving the team the following year, you kind of like, oh, the driver starts going a little bit slower. Is it the team kind of playing games? Is it, you know, you just don't like, you kind of, your brain goes in that conspiracy theory direction. And I do wonder with that, with Hamilton, because they've always been quite close, him and George. And I don't think Lewis is falling off. So I do find it funny that he is struggling.
As a driver looking in, tell us, who do you rate as drivers in F1? And let's have a bit of fun with it. If you could pick your own F1 team, you could structure it. You could pick two drivers, maybe from this season or the past few years, and a team principal. Who would you go for?
I'd probably pick Fred Vasseur. I think he's pretty good at the political side of things. I think Verstappen, for obvious reasons, he's just going to be a weapon. And clearly, if you can design a car around him, like, you can build a fast car. And then I'm kind of torn between Oscar and Lando. Oscar surprised me. Like, I knew he'd be quick, but I didn't know he would. I didn't know he would catch up to Lando so quickly. You know, especially when you consider that Lando had already established himself within the team. That's actually a cool thing about McLaren. I don't think they really do the number one, number two driver thing, at least not anymore, like some of the other teams do. They really let them fight and duke it out and let the best driver win.
Do you think Oscar would do better against Max with the pressure than Lando?
That's an interesting point. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. It seems like he hasn't really been put under pressure yet, despite Lando being Lando. So yeah, I think he might cope better.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Go on then, Nadia. I'm going to put you on the spot now.
Oh no.
who's your team principal and your two drivers?
Fred Vasseur is a good one. I do like James Vowles though as well. So I think let's go with him. We probably should have taken Max out of the equation for the purpose of this. But I don't know. You've got a great one there. Oscar, let's go for young drivers. Yeah, Oscar. Well, I would really like to see Alex Albon do well. I don't know if that's just because he's such a nice guy, but looking at next year, you know, looking at the Red Bull team, if there was a spot there, if Checo doesn't get it, I want to see Albon there.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'd like to see Alex, you know, really, really competing up the top there. I'd just bring back Günther Steiner. He'd be my boss. I'd just get Steiner back in and I'd take Bottas for sure. The reinvented Bottas with his genius acting skills, he'd be an absolute
It's supposed to be a successful team. Not just fun.
Comedic
just vibes.
Fun. Just vibes, yeah. Now, Cameron, we have three final questions which we ask all of our guests. They throw up a myriad of answers. Nadia, I'm going to come to you first for question number one.
Okay, Cameron, what's got you most excited at the moment? It doesn't have to be anything to do with racing.
At the moment, actually, it's kind of the AI integrations with content, I think, is fascinating. On my latest video, it's about the F1 Drive track, my first impressions of that, the F1's kart track in Tottenham. We have two languages other than English on there. We have Spanish and German so far. And it's all in my voice, but I'm speaking fluent Spanish and German. And it's fascinating. And we've had a bunch of comments saying like, this is insane. Like it's perfect. Like the grammar is perfect and it's in my voice. I mean, it sounds exactly like me. So that is something that's really exciting. AI is advancing so quickly. It's kind of unbelievable. And figuring out how to like integrate that into content workflow is something I'm fascinated by.
I love that. That's mental. That is Seriously clever tech. There's one you should check out if you like this sort of thing. There's a, you know, ChatGPT, where you type in a prompt and it gives you an answer about whatever you want. There's one which does images, which is called Kria.ai. I don't know if you've had a go at that.
No, I haven't.
So if you can get a free account at Kria, which is Kria.ai. And it's you type in anything, you know, like, I don't know, racing driver with 10 legs and 6 arms, and it'll do you a drawing or a hyper-realistic photograph of whatever your prompt is. So it's a bit like ChatGPT, but imagery, and it's free. But some of the stuff it throws up is absolutely insane. You should have a crack at that as well. It'll be right up your street.
Definitely.
Number two, what's one lesson your job has taught you that you think everyone should learn at some point in their life?
Oh, it depends on what you consider my job to be. I feel like none of like being a race car driver doesn't count as a real job, and being a content creator doesn't count as a real job. But if we use those two as the example, I'd say it's never give up. Be willing to pivot, because the amount of times the path has changed. I every year in racing, I didn't know if I was going to be racing the next year. So there were a couple years where I was absolutely sure I wouldn't be racing the next year, and then some deal pulled through at the last second. But during that time where I was pretty sure I had to pivot, I didn't just sit there and like cry for 3 months. You know, I actually tried to figure out something new. So at one point it was like, the plan B was like, all right, I'm going to go into entertainment law because I loved the film industry and wanted to, you know, go in Hollywood a different direction. And then another time where I thought I wasn't racing again, I got into trading and just studied the markets as much as possible. And then the third one was content creation. So yeah, I think the moral of the story is just be willing to pivot. And just because you're changing paths doesn't mean it's not a better one.
That is such a valuable skill, being able to pivot. And I would say, Cameron, it is a real job being a content creator. This has been my full-time career for years, but I've only been able to do it because I've been able to pivot like you. It's been, I mean, I didn't watch a single motorsport 2 years ago, and now this is something that I'm doing, you know. So I love that answer. We have one more, last question. And, you know, you're a racing driver. You're obviously okay with speed, but tell us something that you are scared of.
Spiders. that's probably about it, honestly. I mean, yeah, I could make some philosophical thing about fear of failure or whatever, but yeah, it's probably just spiders.
So you're glad you're not in Australia this weekend?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's probably the only reason I haven't been, honestly. Yeah,
the land where everything wants to eat you. Yeah. Cameron, it's been fascinating talking to you. It's a lot more has come out of this than I was expecting, in a way. It sounds like you're a man of many talents, with your head screwed on, and very intellectual brain, and quite a business brain as well. And the content stuff is incredible. I mean, the growth that you've had is quite astonishing. I hope to see you back in a race car, though, at some point. And I'm sure we'll see you trackside soon. But for now, Cameron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.